The health care bill unveiled today by Senate Republicans was crafted in secret, despite criticism from their Democratic colleagues. But it's hardly the first time American politics have been shaped behind closed doors. For a look back at the history, we're joined by Nathan Connolly and Joanne Freeman. They're historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Welcome back.
Hey.
Thanks for having us.
And let's go back to the start, Nathan, to the Constitutional Convention, which was totally out of the public eye, right?
Right. So the Constitutional Convention of 1787 was in secret in large measure to keep the deliberations free from interference and political pressure. One can imagine that on the international stage, there were a number of foreign nations who might be interested in shaping the country's founding document.
Right.
So the need to have something in chambers was absolutely critical to the establishment of the country.
What were the founders afraid of, Joanne? Was it just foreign countries looking in, or was it people here in this country seeing what was going on?
They were very afraid of people in this country. They, their words for it was that they did not want to disturb public repose. Really, this was going to be potentially a major shift in government, and they knew by making the government stronger as they were that people would be afraid that this was going to be a monarchy. And they assumed that if it were open, people in the room who were needing to debate would be too scared to be extreme in their thoughts, and they wanted to open it for a full experiment. And they assumed that if it were open, people would be afraid to change their minds because they would – people watching would assume that they should be consistent. So they meant it. But the important thing about that secrecy is, given that secrecy, they of course assumed at the end that there was going to be a public debate over it.
Right.
And of course, ultimately the ratification conventions around in every state – they had a big, full debate. So it was secrecy, and then it was balanced out by, I guess, what you could call democracy.
But they did end up with a pretty good constitution, if I do say so myself. So
I'm awfully fond
of
it, too.
You wrote it, did you? Oh,
well,
I didn't know.
Is this a good way to do business in secret?
Well, you can certainly see the advantage of needing to have a space for deliberation, for debate. But there's always a tension throughout the country's history. The value of kind of discretion and the need to have something that is free from public pressure and, of course, the need to shed light on the processes of government.
So how long did this tradition of legislative secrecy continue, Joanne?
Well, in the 1790s, the House of Representatives in this new government opened itself up to the public. The Senate did not. And people did not particularly love the fact that the Senate was closed. So in 1793, 1794, people began to protest. They didn't like being shut out. And in part because of that, in 1795, the doors were opened.
And now we know what's going on in the Senate.
And now we do. In this period,
except
some of those years. Yeah. Except that room of 13 people.
Right. Except where they're actually crafting the legislation.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yes, except for that.
Well, one of the things that people might remember is the party nomination process. Before the conventions last summer, we did several stories about the fact that presidential candidates used to be decided in smoke-filled rooms, which eventually changed. But Nathan, let's move forward to like the 20th century. How else did things change when it comes to secrecy?
Well, baked into Washington's culture is a kind of secrecy that even is at its height in the so-called Progressive Era, when everyone is supposed to be initiating certain kinds of reforms for the improvement of government. So you look at Woodrow Wilson, who, you know, during his effort to basically purge the federal bureaucracy of African American workers, much of that was done by phone and over long weekends to prevent there from being pushback. You know, the FBI, as a critical piece of Washington's administrative life, began its life as an organization that surveilled the movements of socialists and anarchists and, you know, dissidents of color largely in secret. And the establishment of COINTELPRO later in the 20th century was a direct feature of J. Edgar Hoover's experience as a 1920s era field agent keeping track of these organizations. So what you're describing relative to the election of officials through the political conventions is, you know, one articulation among many in the nation's capital. And I think it's also really important to note that even during the height of the Cold War, this tension is still very much front and center, right? So after the Manhattan Project, classified information really does begin to explode as part of the federal bureaucracy. By the same turn, however, you know, the contrast of the United States with the Soviet Union during that period was precisely on this question of transparency and openness. And so there's a way in which many reformers tried to look at the Soviet Union and say, look, we are in danger in this country of having a paper curtain that is an echo of the Soviet Union's iron curtain. if we do not
have... I had never heard that before.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. There's actually a lone congressman from California, a man by the name of John Moss, who really is the grandfather of freedom of information. And the argument that he made in the early 1950s was that it's our job to tear down the paper curtain and really make the federal government a site of transparency. And that, in large measure, starts to prompt a nationwide movement that ultimately leads to the signing of the Freedom of Information Act in 1966 under President Lyndon Johnson.
And how important is that act? I mean, remind us what exactly that does.
So the Freedom of Information Act is about creating openness and a public record around meetings, around congressional spending, really putting into the federal register the goings-ons of government. Now, there's an interesting tension here that runs directly through the Johnson era, Nixon era, and so forth, which is that even as these new measures are being placed in place under FOIA, there's a kind of tension between the Congress and the White House. It's in presidents' interests, under the banner of executive privilege, to really control the flow of information. So one could certainly imagine someone like Lyndon Johnson wanting to be able to coerce behind closed doors, or even someone like Nixon being someone who trafficked in secrets. But almost every president between FDR and Obama has had a somewhat antagonistic relationship to freedom of information. It was, in fact, over a veto from Gerald Ford that the expansion of FOIA in the wake of Watergate had to happen, right? Ford was opposed to the expansion of freedom of information. So the way in which the White House has related to the problems of openness and transparency has been in part about national security and in part been about simply, you know, the government doing its business. But I think it's pretty fair to point out that there's an expansion of classification in the wake of the Freedom of Information Act being passed, that the idea of national security, a holdover from the earlier Cold War period, becomes broader and broader and broader to the point where so much information is now almost suffering under a blanket classification in response to the concerns about transparency.
Well, Joanne, do you see any way for that tide to turn, for us to go more in the direction of openness and less in this, let's just classify everything so that it's all top secret and nobody can see it?
Well, you know, one of the distinctive things about what's going on now, of course, and in particularly in comparison with what I was talking about earlier about the Senate being closed or the Constitutional Convention, is that Nathan was just talking about the executive branch. And the founding folk assumed that one of the things the executive branch could do was maintain secrecy and dispatch, I think, were the words that they stuck together. They assumed and actually wanted, in one way or another, the legislative branch to be representative. Now, Nathan just used the word security, and that's one really good reason for secrecy. The other end of that spectrum is secrecy to boost power, right?
Right.
And the moment that we're in is a really interesting moment along those lines. I do feel that the press and the public play an important role in what happens as a result of this moment.
What do you mean by that?
I mean that the public and the press should register what they are thinking about how this is working out. You know, I mean, I think that they are registering on all sides more what they're thinking about things. But I do think in the past, often Americans took the process for granted. And we can't.
And to that point of process, Jeremy, I think it's important to point out that even if we as a country have a kind of rising moral concern with secrecy or overclassification, the bureaucracy has, in many cases, a life of its own. I mean, we have some 2,000 people who have the authority to classify documents in this country. And believe it or not, there are more than 2,000 different federal guides, some of them 100 pages long or more than 100 pages long, determining how one can classify information. And so, you know, the way in which we may hope for kind of light to be shed on any number of government actions or functions will run directly into the ability of us to be able to remake this bureaucracy that's been built really since the last 100 years.
Let's just come back to today before we let you both go and ask, have you ever seen any major piece of legislation being done in secret like this?
I mean, I'm given that my eyes tend to cast back pre-20th century,
right,
to me, what is most striking about this moment is not so much the secrecy, but the fact that only one party is in that room.
Mm-hmm.
It's the polarization that I think is part of the problem. If that was a not one-party group, I think there might be less extreme concern. That, to me, seems like that's something that's very particularly of our moment.
Right. And if we decide to expand just a little bit what we consider to be kind of interests in the room, I mean, you raised the point, Jeremy, about political conventions. The Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party in the mid-1960s was trying to break its way into what was basically a closed political process to them, right? Their interests were not represented by Southern Democrats. They certainly weren't being represented by what was perceived to be the establishment Democrats, even from the North. And so there was a way in which I think, you know, the expansion of that political party's ability to represent the constituents of the South was exactly about this very power of who gets to craft the legislation that determines the allocations of, you know, basic rights and citizenship. And so I'm happy to say at least that the memory of the civil rights era provides some cautionary tale, I think, for what's going on now in the Senate. But I think we should also be very clear and careful about describing what we're seeing as somehow being unprecedented. There's a long history of disenfranchisement and people being excluded that should chasten us from accepting this as the kind of new status quo.
You may now both leave the room. We're going to deal with some secret stuff at this point. Nathan Connolly and Joanne Freeman, historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Thank you so much, as always.
Thank you.
Thanks,
John,
for having us.